The final vote on whether wrestling will remain an Olympic sport takes place this weekend. So, will the sport many connect with the original Olympics be ousted? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Nice Guy, a.k.a. Scott Sipker, has surfaced again, and this time to support wrestling's bid to regain its Olympic spot. We'll talk with him in the first half hour. Before that, we'll find out about new rules curtailing doctors' ability to dispense abortion-inducing pills via a video conferencing system. Then we begin our series of conversations with Iowa College and University presidents at the start of the academic year. Joining us live in the second half hour, University of Iowa President Sally Mason. That's all coming up right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later on this hour, Iowa Nice Guy, a.k.a. Des Moines actor and filmmaker Scott Sipker, will join us. He's surfaced again, and this time it's in support of wrestling's bid to regain its Olympic spot for 2020 and 2024, that coming up in just a few minutes. In the second half hour, we'll begin our series of conversations with Iowa College and University presidents to start this new academic year. Joining us live in the second half hour, University of Iowa President Sally Mason. But first, a few days ago, a state panel that oversees and regulates physicians and medical practices in Iowa voted to adopt rules curtailing doctors' ability to dispense abortion-inducing pills via a video conferencing system. The Iowa Board of Medicine voted 8-2 to approve administrative rules that would establish standards of practice for physicians who prescribe and administer abortion-inducing drugs. Joining us now to talk a little bit about it, explain these new rules, Mark Bowden is with us in our Des Moines studio, Iowa Board of Medicine Executive Director. Mark Bowden, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
Now, I understand the revised rules could take effect sometime in October. What would this change mean for women in Iowa seeking these type of pills?
Sure. The rules will be published in October, and they would become effective in November. The focus of the rules really have to do with the physician involvement with the patient, and so if anything, the first thing would be more engagement with the physician in a physical examination of the woman, as well as the administering of the pill, physically present when the pill that would induce the abortion is administered.
Mm-hmm. So the change here for women, I understand these are new rules, the change here for a woman would be that what could have been a discussion with a doctor over a video conferencing system may no longer take place should these rules be come into effect in November, right?
Well, the conference would take place, but it wouldn't be over the video system. And also, the a physical examination by the physician would occur prior to the administration of the drug.
Mm-hmm. Why does that make a difference? You discussed this, no doubt, with the Iowa Board of Medicine, the 10 members on that board. What were the things discussed that when you looked at the difference it makes between having a real two people in a room, a doctor and a patient, and one of them on a video screen in a live video conference?
Well, prior to that consultation, I have to go back to the physical examination by the physician, which the Board of Medicine believes is fundamental care, a fundamental prelude to prescribing. And it's a fundamental step for the physician to identify any contraindications that might be there, to assess the woman's health, certainly to determine the age of the pregnancy as well as the location. So that's an important step that the board wants to occur, and they want that to occur by a physician. As far as the consultation goes, or at the time that the pill is actually administered, the board believes that the law requires that the physician be present when that pill is administered, and so the physical presence would be there.
Mm-hmm. What prompted these new rules? How did it start?
Well, the rules were really promulgated by a petition that the board received on June 25th. It was a petition that was calling for standards of practice for physicians. The board does not have standards of practice for physicians who prescribe and administer abortion-inducing drugs. The petition was signed by 14 individuals, including five physicians, and it was supported by a separate petition signed by 20,000 Iowans. The board accepted the petition, and the board accepted the language that the petition proposed for the rule change. And so on June 28th, the board voted to accept the petition, and that started the rulemaking process. And there were several steps between June 28th and last Friday, August 30th. The board voted 8-2 to adopt the rule and to file that notice, which sets it on course for official publication in the Iowa Administrative Bulletin and then effective in November 6th.
Mark Bowden is with us, Iowa Board of Medicine Executive Director, talking about, just mentioned last Friday, the board voting to adopt rules curtailing doctors' ability to dispense abortion-inducing pills via a video conferencing system, not curtailing in a way that may not happen after these rules go into effect, is what I hear you're saying. We want to mention here, too, that we reached out to Planned Parenthood of the Heartland to be part of this discussion. They declined to participate in today's program. So, Mark Bowden, on the board there, you have 10 members of the board, I'm gathering, 8-2. How many women, how many men?
There are five women and five men. Mm-hmm. The board is composed of seven physicians and three public members. The physicians include a radiation oncologist, a surgeon, two general family practitioners, a physician who specializes in geriatric medicine. I'm just thinking here. I might have hit five. The others... The public members, we have three public members that includes an attorney, a priest, and she's now retired, but she had been the physician services administrator for a large clinic.
Mm-hmm. When you would just roughly say how many hours you spent talking about this, what would you come up with as a rough estimate when this one new rule adoption?
Well, the board received the petition on the 25th, and coincidentally was scheduled to meet later in the week. The board took that petition up at a public meeting on June 28th. There was discussion at that meeting. The board, I can't speak for the individual board members, but the board then took public comment. We took written public comment for 35 days, and that culminated with a public hearing in Des Moines on August 28th. There was 3.5 hours of testimony there, and then on August 30th, prior to the board voting on it, there was discussion on it. It took it was discussed at two public meetings as well as the public hearing.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that there was a priest. There is a priest on the board.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not purely a medical decision based on medical science.
Well, I can't speak to that. I think the board makes its decisions based on the practice of medicine. The public members have an interesting role in that. All of the public members would come to the table without the medical knowledge or the medical principles and so forth, but they have a role in that discussion. They carry their vote carries the same weight as a physician member, but the physician members who supported this rule talked of it in terms of medical standards of practice. It was very much a discussion of medical standards of practice. At the end of the two votes that opposed the rules, one was a public member and one was a physician, and I think that their positions generally were that they were not prepared to vote, that they wanted more discussion on it. I'm not sure that they actually opposed the rules per se, but they didn't feel that they were prepared to vote.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's impossible for any rules, additional rules in this case, having to do with abortion, not having a political dimension. I think we can agree on that. Has that been that aspect been a challenge in this case in deciding this, discussing it?
I think so. I think that, as you say, that the board has tried very hard to separate the issue of abortion and what they have adopted are standards of practice for physicians. That the standards of practice are not determining whether abortion is right or wrong. It's setting forth standards that the board would expect physicians to follow who perform the abortion. And so it's tried very hard to avoid the political discussion, if you will. I know at the public hearing there were individuals who wanted to talk about abortion generally. There were comments made that perhaps the rules didn't go far enough, mm-hmm. and so forth. But the board was quick to stem that and to say the focus is really on what is standards of practice. But that said, there certainly has been a community discussion, and the board has received a lot of comments for and against the rules from around the state and around the nation.
So at this point in the process, you said they will be take effect in November. Is is that the end of public input, or can the public have input in the process at this point still?
Well, at some point, as in the rulemaking process goes, the Iowa Administrative Rules Review Committee, which is a legislative committee that has some oversight on rulemaking, that committee is forever reviewing rules that agencies develop and notice and ultimately adopt. This rule went before that committee on August 6th, and any time a rule is reviewed by that committee meets in a public setting, and that committee entertains public comment on the rule. And on August 6th, it was reviewed by the committee, and there were, I think, six or eight presentations made at that time to the legislative committee. There were lots of questions asked by the legislators on that committee, and there was a motion taken at that time to stop the rulemaking process. That motion was defeated. That committee has authority to intervene in a rulemaking process. In this case, it didn't have the votes to do that. Now that the rule has been adopted, it would face a second pass by the Administrative Rules Review Committee, and perhaps even more. I think that committee could has the prerogative to review any rule mm-hmm. any time. But if it's scheduled, there would be public opportunity for comment at at that time.
And briefly, before we say goodbye to you, Mark Bowden, where does this place Iowa in this context in relation to how other states handle a doctor's ability to dispense abortion-inducing pills? Are they also – how many do allow, for instance, video conferencing systems to be part of the system in which you have this consultation?
I know that the latest reports are that there are 16 states that have laws or rules that would not allow the video conference dispensing of the pill. So I would suspect that the remaining states have taken no position or rules on that per se. Iowa may be one of a handful of states where this practice occurs today. I think there's some question as to exactly where else in the nation it occurs. The latest information we had received was that there was possibly three states where this system is being used, but we haven't been able to verify that in the other two states that were suggested.
Thank you for coming into our studio today, Mark Bowden, Iowa Board of Medicine Executive Director. We appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you so much.
Coming up in about 15 minutes, a live conversation with University of Iowa President Sally Mason will be in our Iowa City studio. But before that, oh boy, the Iowa nice guy is back. This character born in the minds of Des Moines actor and filmmaker Scott Sipker and his film partner Paul Benedict has surfaced again, and this time to support wrestling's bid to regain its Olympic spot for 2020 and 2024. Wrestling is competing for the final spot in those two Olympic cycles. the final vote this weekend, this Sunday in Argentina, before talking with, yeah, we're going to talk with him, Iowa nice guy, see how nice he is, Scott Sipker. Let's listen to some excerpts from the video.
An Olympic gold medal is the pinnacle of wrestling. That's not the case in the Olympic sports: rugby, cycling, tennis, boxing, soccer, basketball, and golf. A gold medal in those sports means as much as getting to kiss a smoking hot girl's hand.
It's great, but not what you dream about.
Maybe you think wrestling isn't popular enough. You know, I think you're right. If you ignore the fact that 180 countries have wrestling governing bodies.
In 2020, there'll be 26 sports in the Olympics. Can you honestly tell me there's 26 sports more Olympic than wrestling?
So next time you find yourself voting for what is or isn't an Olympic sport, just remember the Olympics aren't the Olympics without wrestling. I'm out.
Iowa Nice Guy's latest effort, Scott Sipker there. Most of the voice there, one voice in there, Tom Arnold. Scott Sipker joining us by phone. Hi. Hi, Scott.
Hello, thank you for having me.
A hilarious video, making a very important point, not just hilarity for its own sake, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. People really have to watch this video because you've pulled out some stops here that I didn't think you didn't have this extent of celebrity, let's say it that way, in your previous videos. Tom Arnold, we heard his voice there. We also had another part there with Jay Moore, comedian, actor, and nationally syndicated radio host there. In the nude, I have to kind of provide the visuals because, of course, we have to imagine them on radio. Let's listen to Jay Moore singing a little bit in this video.
You ever heard of the wheel? Well, before it was invented, cave paintings around 7,000 BCE depicted two men wrestling in the nude.
In the nude, without any clothes on, yeah!
Jay Moore there. Don't worry, folks. It's family-friendly. He's been pixelated, right?
That's right. I told Jay we would pixelate a larger area than needed just so everybody had a better opinion of him.
Tell us, how did you come up with this idea?
Well, as soon as the IOC decided to eliminate wrestling from the Olympics back at the beginning of the year, instantly I thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity to break out the Iowa Nice Guy character, seeing that wrestling in Iowa are so tightly niched. And plus, I like to get behind causes, if you will, and messages that are completely common sense and have tons of facts behind them, and it's really unarguable. And so this is a perfect combination of that. And so this time I wanted to have some celebrities in there, so I just emailed Tom Arnold, who's become a mentor, I should say. It's probably the best way to put it, about the idea, and he was all about it. And it took one email to ask Jay Moore to be in it, and it took one extra email to ask him if he'd do the nudity, and he said sure, which I was completely surprised by. But nevertheless, he did it. So yeah.
And it took one flight to get out to the Pacific Ocean. In one point, you're making a reference to Lord of the Rings and Bilbo Baggins, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. But and if you look at it, you'll actually see that the waves are crashing in at a different angle, too, because earlier in that line we say Columbus, so we thought it's probably better if we make it look like the Atlantic. So that's actually the reverse of the actual shot we got. So there's a little behind-the-scenes information for you. But we flew out there, Nick Strickland and I flew out there about a week ago. Well, it'll be 2 weeks ago tomorrow, and filmed for 2.5 days, and then came back, got the rest in, say, Iowa City. You see Dan Gable's gold medal from Munich in the piece, so we did some stuff over in Iowa City, also a little bit in Des Moines.
Yeah, I can tell your heart's in it, as many Iowans' hearts are in it, or wrestling fans all around the country, all around the world. Tell us, what is the update on what is happening this weekend?
Yeah, so the IOC will have their final vote. It's you've already filled in a little bit of squash and basketball, softball, which is just one sport in the Olympics' eyes. So it's up against those two. It's a secret ballot that will take place on Sunday, so we really have no idea how it's going to go. Everybody that I talk to in the wrestling community feels pretty confident about it, but it's a very hesitant caution.
Okay, so wait a minute, just to make sure. There's a one spot there, so wrestling competing with squash, and the other sport is?
Baseball, softball. Which is just one sport. So baseball, softball, take out the space.
But, and only one walks away with an Olympic
only
spot.
Only one. Correct. Oh. So there'll be, and that'll make, there's 25 core sports in the Olympics, according to the IOC, and they're going to have one non-core sport, which will make for the 26 that Tom Arnold spoke about in the video. And that one spot is what's up for vote on Sunday. So, and, you know, I've been surprised around the country how many people don't even know that this is going on. So anybody that can get the word out, spread the video, or just tweet the hashtag Save Olympic Wrestling, get it out there, and really bring some attention to it.
Right. Now at this point, will that affect us? It's a vote, a secret vote, as you said. I guess, be frank with me. Now, Scott, squash doesn't have us worried. I'm worried about the baseball and softball thing.
Well, baseball and softball had been in the Olympics and been removed since. So there's that aspect. I think it'd be more threatening. Now, this is just one man's opinion, but it'd be more threatening if it was just softball. But because they have softball and baseball together,
yes,
and baseball already has the World Baseball Classic, it kind of muddies the waters a little bit. And I think that gives wrestling ultimately the advantage over softball, baseball. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to go our way, because everybody was shocked when wrestling first got eliminated from the Olympics earlier this year. When it's a secret ballot and they don't have to give a reason for their vote, surprising things can happen. So it's important just to kind of get the word out there. So maybe an IOC member will come across it and just say, oh, yeah, of course, this is common sense. Let's put wrestling in the Olympics.
Mm. You know, this isn't a hilarious video. People need to check it out. Get behind this move to get wrestling back in the Olympics. But, you know, it's a very funny video, but according to my colleague Charity Nebbe, you know well, you may have missed one of the most hilarious things about wrestling, and that would be unitards.
Oh, yes.
No mention of unitards. All you have to do is say unitards and picture a unitard and you laugh, right?
I had originally, in the very original script, I had Neil Patrick Harris saying a line, something about, you think wrestling's gay? Well, there's nothing gay about wrestling. Well, the singlets are a little gay. But nevertheless, it didn't quite work out. Are we going to get that scheduled? And plus, I thought maybe the line wasn't didn't quite fit in the flow of everything else. But no, it was definitely something we've talked about, and all my wrestling friends have talked about that as well. And that's actually one of the things that the international governing body of wrestling is looking at, is actually changing the uniform and looking to try and modernize it, maybe go to more of a UFC look, and also just add some spice to the matches. I went out to LA I think it was May, to watch the brand new rules of wrestling when America was taking on Canada and Russia. And they really spiced it up. They had some entrance music. They had an announcer. They changed the rules so that the rules now and the points awarded really give an advantage to an aggressive wrestler. So it makes it much more exciting than it was, much more like what it was back when Dan Gable was wrestling.
We have 30 seconds left. Have you ever wrestled, Scott?
One time, PE in seventh grade, I was the last one to go, and all I had to do for my team to win was not get pinned, and then I surprisingly pinned myself. I thought I was pinning the other kid, and I pinned myself. Thank you, Mr. Spieler, for tapping me out on that one.
Oh, it sounds like it still hurts all these years later.
It does hurt. It does hurt.
Iowa nice guy Scott Sipker, thank you for joining us. Do check out his video, the latest one, defending wrestling, making sure it's part of the next Olympics, or 2020 and 2024, that is. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll be joined live by University of Iowa President Sally Mason. If you have a question or a comment, questions directed to 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with University of Iowa President Sally Mason. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining me this half hour, live in our Iowa City studio, University of Iowa President Sally Mason is joining us again. President Mason, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Ben, for having me.
I want to mention, too, that we'll be talking about a variety of topics. We want to have our listeners join in with questions for UI President Sally Mason, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I want to talk, if you don't mind, start off with a little discussion of athletics that's been in the news President Mason. And in this context, I do want to mention that you are chair of the Big Ten Council of Presidents and Chancellors.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just days ago, the NFL and more than 4,500 retired football players reached an agreement calling for the league to contribute $765 million to a fund mm-hmm. that will pay medical and other benefits as well as compensation to those who suffered concussions and related injuries during their careers. Now, just yesterday, I'm not sure you may not have seen this. I popped out. There was news that three former college football players are suing the NCAA, and the suit alleges that the NCAA didn't do enough to assess, treat, and prevent brain trauma following concussions. And the plaintiffs are seeking an NCAA-funded medical monitoring program for former football players. As we learn more and more about the serious long-term damaging effects of head trauma in football and the lawsuits start to snowball, what are the implications for college football's future?
Yeah, you know, Ben, this is something that's been on the minds of a lot of us for actually quite a while. And in fact, the Big Ten more than a year ago formed a partnership with the Ivy League, and the schools themselves are doing research on concussions. I mean, that's exactly what we were interested in, is how do we do a better job not only of preventing concussions, but obviously when concussion occurs, what kinds of treatments are the most effective? How do you best serve these young athletes should they have an unfortunate injury along the way? I think our partnership was prescient in terms of concussion becoming obviously an issue that's on the minds of many, many individuals, especially former athletes who have suffered some ill effects from concussions. So none of this surprises me. I think it would be obviously unfortunate if we don't pay close attention to this and figure out ways in which we can better mitigate injuries and protect our athletes from these types of injuries in the first place, and maybe avoid some of those lawsuits in the future.
Mm-hmm. So what can be done? What conclusions did you reach with the mounting science here?
Yeah.
Is there a way to make football safe at all?
Right. Well, there's a lot of studies underway, and obviously football is safer today than it was 40 or 50 years ago. You just look at the equipment and you can see some of the ways in which they've tried to mitigate these things. But some of it's going to have to be behavior changes, too. I think some of the research is beginning to show us that there's certain types of game day behaviors that if we can get the players and coaches and teams to understand that this type of activity or behavior is it could lead to serious consequences when it comes to concussion, and mm-hmm. we shouldn't be doing that, it could make a big difference in the future. But I think there's still a lot of work. You know, this is still a very young partnership and a lot of research going on right now that I hope will lead to better outcomes in the future.
Now, related to this in the area of athletics, billions of dollars are at stake in college athletics for corporate sponsors, for broadcasters, for the NCAA itself.
Sure.
And the NCAA as a whole, the figure I have, makes $6 billion annually. Players themselves in college do not see any of that money, even as you know, they risk perhaps injury every time they step onto a field or a court mm-hmm. or onto a rink. It's a huge amount of money made off of college sports. And some have said, shouldn't college athletes be not considered amateurs anymore? Should they be paid for their efforts? A lot of money is being made off their efforts.
Sure.
Shouldn't they be paid? This has been a controversy for quite a while.
Sure. Sure. You know, I'm still a very big believer in the student athlete. College athletes, while they're not getting paid a salary to play the sport that they play, many of them are getting full ride scholarships to very fine institutions. And they're getting room and board, and they're getting health care. They're getting, if they're injured, and in fact, some of them are being very well taken care of. And I can point to our own program and say that we've got very good medical support for our student athletes should something happen to them along the way. So there's a lot of things that are part of the student athlete repertoire, shall we say, that I think are sometimes overlooked in all of this. That's not to say that there isn't room for consideration of further kinds of things that will make it possible for student athletes to I hope succeed as students and athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that includes stipends. Maybe that includes something a little different as we go forward in the future. That's a topic that I think will be heavily and hardly discussed in the coming years.
University of Iowa President Sally Mason, my guest this half hour on River to River. I'd like to have you comment on a highly publicized public intoxication arrest of one UI student last weekend. It was a story that made news not only around the state, the nation, but also around the world. Last Saturday, during the opening football game at Kinnick Stadium, a 22-year-old woman, Samantha Gowdy, not sure the pronunciation of that last name, but she was arrested while trying to jump onto the field. She tested 0.341 blood alcohol level. That's more than four times the legal limit for driving. Afterwards, it was her Twitter posts under the handle @vodka_Sam that caught so much media attention. She tweeted, "Just went to jail. You only live once," from a holding cell, then tweeted, "Blew a 341 in jail," and later tweeted, "I'm going to get 341 tattooed on me because it's so epic." And this comes just a few weeks after the designation by the Princeton Review, naming the University of Iowa the number one party school in the nation. Now, we know that drinking in excess is nothing new on college campuses, President Mason, but why do you think that the UI in particular seems to have so much problem here?
Well, we certainly get notoriety for it, and it can be unfortunate. Let me start by saying that I have great concern for Samantha. What she's doing is not healthy. It's very risky. It's very dangerous. And she's a young woman who clearly needs help. And she's not unusual necessarily on college campuses today. There are students that have similar issues with alcohol and drugs that really need to get and see some help for this. And we have great programs. I'm hoping that she will take advantage of some of these programs and perhaps the behaviors will change. Now, that said, obviously I'm not pleased about the party school reputation, and she didn't do us a lot of good in terms of her behavior. One student out of 31,000 is unfortunately shaping the discussion of what the University of Iowa's reputation is. And I would tell you that conversations I've had with faculty, staff, and students in this last week, there's a great deal of concern on our campus for that reputational hit, because the many of our students in particular do not believe that is the University of Iowa that they go to.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, many of our faculty and students alike feel that the programs, the so many programs that we have in the top 10, so many excellent high-quality programs that we have, are really what the University of Iowa is all about. So I'm trying to change the discussion now and get the faculty and staff, again, have these conversations with students about what this means and how unfortunate it is when you get painted by this brush. And I don't think it's entirely fair, but, you know, it's out there and we have to deal with it at this point in time. And it really is going to behoove us to get the students to understand that this, both short-term and long-term, is not helpful to them as students and won't be helpful to them. I had a law student tell me that he was interviewing for a job and got asked the question, "So you're at the number one party school. Tell me how that has influenced your career and why we should hire you." And that's not the kind of question you want to be asked in a job interview. So our students really need to begin to help us and exert some peer pressure on what I think is a much smaller number of students out there that think that this is funny or that this is somehow indicative of the University of Iowa that the rest of us are at. And it's not.
University of Iowa President Sally Mason with us this half hour. Let's go to our phones. Claire in Des Moines has a follow-up comment or question on this very topic, I believe, President Mason. Claire, welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Hi, President Mason.
Hi, Claire.
I'm the chair of the Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Commission. I must tell you that ahead of time. I'm real concerned about, obviously, as almost every adult in the state of Iowa was after listening to Ms. Gowdy's trouble that she had last weekend, self-induced trouble. I was wondering, can you outline for the listeners what the University of Iowa is doing to parents on this issue and how to talk to their kids? And also, is the university tying any consequences to students who may violate these alcohol policies? Can you just elaborate on what steps the university has taken in that regard?
Yeah, you know, Vice President Rocklin has worked very hard to get information out not only to our students on these issues, but to parents as well, especially parents of students who are currently enrolled here, and in particular, where students can go to get help if they have an issue like this. He's also been very, very strident with our Greek houses in terms of getting them to understand that behaviors that are alcohol-related will lead to some serious consequences, including dismissal from campus as a fraternity or sorority, should they, in fact, not be able to conform with the rest of the student body in terms of arrests and those kinds of things. We've got a lot of initiatives going on here. I would direct you to our website or to our student services office, our student life office, and Tom Rocklin's office, and Kelly Bender with our alcohol partnership here in town. The number of things that we've done over the last 5 years to both educate our students about the dangers of this type of behavior and the ways in which this town has become a lot safer for our students and for the residents of Iowa City are notable. And we've got some great data that we can share and we have been sharing with the public that show that, yes, you can have an effect on this with your students, but it requires constant vigilance and a lot of hard work. There's no doubt about that. I know we don't have a lot of time to go into more specifics. Ben's given me the look. So,
sure.
But we've got a lot of information for you out there.
Sure. Thank you for that. And can I just say that we're going to try to have a commission meeting in Iowa City in October, and I would invite you to attend that meeting because I think we're going to be discussing this issue further. So I would invite you to be a part of that conversation, and I thank you for what you've done already.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Claire, calling from Des Moines. I wasn't giving you the look. I was actually looking at my executive producer. So that was unintended. I'm sorry about
that. That's okay.
Let's go to our next caller, Doug in Ames. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure
President
thing.
Mason, I have a question that I've wanted answered for well over a year now. How can you reconcile the athletic department's deal with Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch with your and your entire administration's goal of reducing binge drinking, going all the way back to the Block 21 ordinance a couple years ago that Tom Rocklin, head of student services, spearheaded? I guess the question that I think in a nutshell is, who's making these decisions? Is it the athletic department on their own because they are ostensibly financially independent? You know, it seems like you're sending a very mixed message.
Okay, Doug, we'll get a reaction to that. Not much time. I think we got your point. Let's have the president react to that.
Yeah,
thank you, Doug.
Happy to. You know, Anheuser-Busch, we don't rubber stamp every offer that comes along to provide money to athletics or any other group on campus. Anheuser-Busch, with their Drink Responsibly campaign, is one that all three Regents institutions have embraced. It's true at Iowa State. It's true at the University of Iowa. It's true at UNI. So we think that Anheuser-Busch, because of some of the things that they're trying to do, is sending at least the kind of message that we can embrace and the public should be able to embrace, that you do it legally, you do it safely, and you do it responsibly. So that's the simple answer in a nutshell. And, yes, our athletics department is independent, but they still have to make decisions in the context of the approval of the greater university. That includes my approval.
Okay, thank you, Doug, for that call from Ames. Just a few minutes left. Let's make sure we get to a couple of other topics. President Mason, Board of Regents, the Board of Regents that governs the three state-supported university, plans to ask for enough funding from legislators to enable the schools to freeze tuition, and this would be for the second straight year. Funding requests from not only the University of Iowa, but the University of Northern Iowa and Iowa State University, a meeting next week in Cedar Falls, I believe. It would be the first time in nearly four decades that tuition was held at the same level for two straight years. How hopeful are you that the legislators will grant that amount of funding?
Well, I've had some great opportunities this summer to meet with a number of legislators across the state, and 201, they were thrilled this year to be not only great partners with the Regents institutions, but obviously the outcome being that we could freeze resident tuition. So we're optimistic that second year in a row, we're making a modest budget request. The Regents will make a modest budget request. And if we can do that same type of partnership again, I'm very optimistic that we'll freeze tuition.
What arguments are you using to pry that extra funding out of the legislature?
Well, we're trying to be very careful about how we spend those dollars. And for the University of Iowa, I've been absolutely firm that those dollars go to support student success, that it's really any new appropriations dollars are going to support the academic mission. They're going to support the kinds of things that we've been doing for students to improve our retention and graduation rates. And we've actually seen, and I'll talk a little more about this at the Regents meeting next week, but we've seen some great improvements in both our freshman retention rates as well as now our graduation rates have picked up. And that's the measure, and that's certainly a measure that everyone on the national scene is paying close attention to, is what are the outcomes? Can you get your students to graduate in a timely fashion, and can you get them to graduate faster?
Mm-hmm. Another budgetary issue, what impact have the federal budget cuts we know as sequestration had at the University of Iowa thus far?
Yeah, you know, we're just starting to see some of the effects right now. For example, next week I'll be talking about our enrollment numbers, and I've worked very hard to make sure that our undergraduate enrollment remains stable through some rough times for us, including recovering from the flood. The graduate school, you know, we're starting to see some drop off in the number of graduate students we have coming to the University of Iowa for a couple of reasons, one of which is sequestration. If you can't count on grant money, if you're not sure about whether your grant's going to get approved, then you're not going to bring in graduate students or graduate assistants to be able to help you do the research that you would normally be funded for by the federal government. So sequestration is having an effect on graduate enrollment. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that.
Do you have some numbers to share with us?
Not yet. No, we're one day away right now from final numbers. So I'll have those numbers at the Board of Regents meeting on next week.
The Bell and Blank International Center for Gifted Education and mm-hmm. Talent Development mm-hmm. at the University of Iowa's College of Education celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And I understand that the University of Iowa is proposing to the Regents to have gifted students in the Bell and Blank program merge 2 years of high school with the first 2 years of college. So this would mean—
Isn't that exciting?
So tell me about that. I'm trying to think of maybe 16-year-old students from somewhere in high school students. Actually, what would they live in Iowa City?
Well, they might. What would happen is by the time they graduated high school, they'd have 2 years of college under their belt. So they'd actually start at the university as juniors. Imagine that. They could graduate before they were 20 years old in some cases. These obviously would be extraordinary students, but it's also, you know, it's a way in which we can promote some of the truly gifted and fast-paced students that we know are out there to begin that college education as quickly as possible, perhaps get them tracked into whatever their career goal might be. If it's medicine, we could have some very young doctors out there.
not surprisingly. Sure sounds like it.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, we think it's, again, a way to make certain that we keep the cost of college down as much as we can. And if it's a gifted and talented student, is there really a reason to make them stay in college longer than necessary if, in fact, they can complete that work in a much faster-paced environment? And that's what it's all about.
We've got a couple minutes, perhaps a moment for reflection. I'll ask you. You and Iowa State University President Stephen Leith given 4% salary increases this year. Your salary climbs to $513,000. But I wonder, how has your job as president changed over time? We've talked about budget issues. The impression is that a university president these days, not just you, spends less time concerning him or herself with academics and education and a lot more time spent traveling and fundraising.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that the tendency, the big picture for your job?
It's been that way actually for a while, and it's certainly no surprise to those of us who have become university presidents in the last decade. More and more, especially at public universities, we rely on a variety of sources of revenue to help the university grow. And I have to say, since my arrival here a little more than 6 years ago now, the fundraising has gone exceedingly well. It's a great team that we have. We're in the middle of a very, very large comprehensive campaign, the most aggressive comprehensive campaign not only ever at the University of Iowa, but ever in the state of Iowa. $1.7 billion. And we're $1.1 billion on the way towards that goal. I've got 3 years to complete the goal of $1.7 billion. So I'm going to be probably doing even more traveling. I rely heavily on the fact that I've got a great provost, a great academic vice president who can handle many of the academic issues. I don't ignore them, certainly, but I'm not on campus nearly as much as he is, not surprisingly, because I will be working with our alumni, our friends, donors, people who care deeply about the University of Iowa, and people who care about the kinds of things that are happening at the University of Iowa.
President Sally Mason, president of the University of Iowa, thank you for taking the time to share with us some of your thoughts. Yes, you're looking at the clock. It's already over.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you
appreciate
for joining.
It.
I appreciate you coming in. University of Iowa President Sally Mason. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden. Technical support also from Emily Woodbury this hour. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk show is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. Get in touch with us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thank you.